I believe that our speaker today, Philip Yancey, is the greatest Christian writer of our time. When I first became the pastor here back in 1996, my mentor, Leighton Ford, happened to show up around that time. He's a Christian leader originally from Ontario as well, the brother-in-law to the late Billy Graham. And Leighton and I were taking a walk through one of the trails in Stanley Park, and then he paused and he turned to me and he said, "Ken," he knew that I had worked as a journalist for a little while in Southern California. "Now that you're a pastor, have you ever thought about writing for a Christian audience?" And I said, "No." And Leighton says, "Well, why wouldn't you consider that?" And I said, "Well, I'll never be able to write as well as Philip Yancey." And Leighton said, "Well, that's true." So Philip Yancey is such a great writer, he depresses me. But more than depresses me, he inspires me through his words. Many a Christmas, I have reached for his amazing book, The Jesus I Never Knew, and opened it up for some inspiration and have read about his viewing a state visit from Queen Elizabeth and all the pomp and circumstance, and then comparing it to how God comes into the world as a lowly servant born in a stable. On countless times, I have drawn words from his book, What's So Amazing About Grace? Words like, "There is nothing that you can do to make God love you less. And there's nothing you can do to make God love you more." Such gifts. And so I'm thrilled that he has taken a couple of his classics and woven them together into this new volume, Fearfully and Wonderfully, The Marvel of Bearing God's Image. And he will also show us how we can bear God's image in the direction of some of the world's most vulnerable. And so without any further ado, would you give a very warm welcome, not a polite sort of Canadian Vancouver pitter-patter, but a very enthusiastic and rousing welcome to Philip Yancey, one of the great authors of our time. An honor to have you here. Thank you.
Yeah, if the church doesn't work out, Ken, I got a job for you as my publicity manager. So, and to all of you, thanks for coming. You could be taking one of those trails in Stanley Park on a sunshiny day, but instead you came here in the middle of the afternoon. You know the American humorist Mark Twain? He says, "In hell, it's always 2 o'clock in the afternoon." So thank you. We'll try to turn it into a more heavenly experience today. And I'm going to start with a quiz on U.S. culture. Okay, I brought you a picture. See if you can identify who this is. You know that guy? Mr. Rogers. Did Mr. Rogers make it up here? His neighborhood was at large? Okay, great. Well, one of the things Mr. Rogers did, whenever he spoke, he would always say, and there's a little clip of that in the film, he would always say, "Okay, I want you to stop, and for 2 minutes, I want you to think of someone who profoundly changed your life." And actually, 2 minutes is a long time if I did that right now. You know, my time's too valuable. I'm not going to do that. But Mr. Rogers was invited one time to speak at the White House, and he was given 8 minutes. Ronald Reagan was president, and he had this vow that he would always devote 2 minutes to this little exercise. And he thought, "That's 25% of my time. Do I really want to do that?" But he said, "No, I agreed that I would do that." So he did. And he said later, it's probably the only 2 minutes of his speech that they remember, because Ronald Reagan was sitting there, you know, to be silent in the White House for 2 minutes. That's pretty heavy duty. I wish it happened more often, actually. And And then he could see, and Ronald Reagan came up to him afterwards and said, "Oh man, I thought of my teacher who really got me turned into reading. I wasn't much of a reader, and she really turned the corner. I hadn't thought of her in years." And he looked over in the corner, and there was one of the butlers who had been serving them breakfast. And this butler had tears shining down his face, and he said, "Oh, I thought of my uncle who taught me to fish. My father never had time for me, but his brother came, and he taught me to fish. I hadn't thought of him in years." And if I did that, it would easily be the person that I co-wrote this book with, Dr. Paul Brand. I spent 10 years of my life, very formative years. I'll show you a picture of what Dr. Brand looked like. He was an orthopedic surgeon from England when I met him. I was writing a book called Where Is God When It Hurts? My first book, really. This is 1977. And I had been interviewing all these people who had gone through tragedy. I didn't know what to say. Some people are saying God did it. Some people are saying, no, it's the devil. Some people are saying, no, God did it, but not because he doesn't like you, because he likes you and wants you to be an example. Who needs friends like that? I didn't know what to say to these people I'm interviewing. And so I decided, and I've learned ever since, if I don't know the answer to something, write a book about it. Right, Ken? Then you can spend a long time thinking about it, going to the Bible, trying to find some answers. And in that process, I was spending a lot of time in seminaries and in libraries reading books on the problem of pain, the curse of pain. And my general conclusion was, God created a pretty good world, except for this thing called pain. If we could just get rid of that, then he gets an A+. And Dr. Brand had an entirely different viewpoint. My wife was working in a medical supply house that provided medicines to missions hospitals, and she was cleaning out a closet one day and found a speech by this Dr. Brand, I'd never heard of him, on the gift of pain. And in that, he said, if I had one gift I could give my leprosy patients, it would be the gift of pain. Thank God for pain, one of his greatest inventions. I said, what? So I called this guy up out of the blue. I'll show you a picture of me at the time. I'm like 27 years old, you know, writing a book on the problem of pain, right? And I said, I've never heard anybody who had these kind of ideas about pain. Could I come and interview you? He said, well, I don't know, I'm pretty busy. I said, well, I'll just sit in the hallway, and if you have 5 minutes here or lunch there, you know, I'd like to explore your ideas. And that began a friendship with a person who influenced me more than anybody ever. My father died when I was 1 year old, back in one of the polio epidemics. So I had never had a father. And Dr. Brand became a father figure for me. Actually, it works very well. You don't have to go through that whole teenage rebellion individuation. You know, just find a person who is an ideal father and invite him into your life when you're 27. It worked great. And he was the one who discovered the truth about leprosy. Most people thought of leprosy, well, there are several misconceptions. They thought it was terribly contagious, so they would make them live outside the village. Actually, 95% of people are naturally immune. You couldn't get leprosy if they injected it in your body. You just have but then 5% of people aren't. And we thought of it as kind of like MRSA or jungle rot. You know, your body just starts, your flesh starts decaying. Doesn't work like that at all. All the abuse in leprosy comes about because people with leprosy don't feel pain. And then as I got to know different patients, I heard their stories. I met this one guy who was a salesman, and he was supposed to wear these clunky-looking orthopedic shoes to protect his feet. But, you know, you can't sell furniture wearing shoes like that. So he would insist on wearing these narrow, pointed-toed shoes, and the doctors would say, don't do that. It's going to hurt your feet. Well, of course, he didn't feel pain. So it did hurt his feet. He would get blisters and calluses, but he never went to a doctor because it didn't hurt. And then gradually there would be an infection, and his body would absorb the bone. By the time I saw him, he had no toes at all. His foot was just a rounded stump because he wore shoes too tight. And of course, people with diabetes have to watch that for the same reason. About a third of people with leprosy go blind. Why do they go blind? They go blind because they don't have pain cells. We have a little pain cell in our eye. The entire time I've been talking, you guys have been blinking. It's not because you're trying to go to sleep, maybe, but you blink about 28,000 times a day. because your eye needs that lubrication. Every time you blink, it moisturizes it. But if you decided, I'm not going to blink until he finishes talking, there's no way you're going to do it, right? Maybe 2 minutes is a pretty long time. 5 minutes, you're in excruciating pain. But if you don't have that pain, your eyes can dry out and leprosy patients go blind. So I learned facts like that from Dr. Bram, but more than that, far more than that, he influenced my faith. We ended up writing 3 books together, and then, as Ken mentioned, this last one, I took kind of the best of all of our work and reworked it. Medicine has changed, science has changed. Dr. Brand has died, so I could tell stories that I couldn't tell when he was alive, you know, that whole thing. But I had never met someone who could put together faith and science and theology and the whole world in the way he did. He looked through this one prism. This is God's world. And when I see the human body, when I see the universe, when I see leprosy patients, you know, he had a way of putting it all together, which deeply affected me. The subtitle is The Marvel of Bearing God's Image. And I've thought a lot about that word image. In fact, it appears very early, the book of Genesis. Genesis chapter 1, verses 26 and 27. Listen to this. It's almost as if God is lecturing it to first graders, because he repeats himself like 3 times in the first 2 sentences. He says, God says, let us make mankind in our image, in our likeness, so that they may rule over the earth. So God created humankind in God's own image. In the image of God, he created them. Did you get that? Just over and over. I guess that's like 5 times if you add them all up. The image of God is very important. So what is the image? What is the image of God? Well, people misuse that word today. We have different ways of using it. So for most of us, we live in a very image-conscious culture. It's an entertainment culture, and you got to have the right image. So if you're a rap musician, you would never dress like this, right? No. You would have shaved head, you'd have tattoos everywhere, you know, you'd be like edgy and piercings and things like that, because you got to live up to your image. You actually might be a little teddy bear, but we don't know that, you know, you got to sell records. And if you're a CEO of a company, you don't dress like a rap musician. You wouldn't get hired if you had all those tattoos. So you dress more like this, maybe even have to wear a tie if you're unlucky. That's what we think of as image today. And politicians, for example, all these people running for president of the United States, they all have image makers. They have an image team. And President Donald Trump has an entire army of cleaning up after his tweets each day. These are people trying to repair his image, no, to dust up his image. I'm sure Justin Trudeau has no such problem. That's not what God means. It's not like to pretend to be something that you're not. That's kind of how we use it now. Live up to an image. God says, no, and I want you human beings, different than any other animal, I want you to be the carriers of my likeness, of my image, so that when people wonder, what is God like, they can look at you. And there's an image of me, God, in you, human beings. The closest thing I can find, and I don't know where this phrase came from, have you ever heard the phrase spitting image? Spitting image. You look at a little baby. In fact, I brought a picture. That's my brother Marshall on the left, and that's our father, who I never knew because I was a year old when he died, on the right. And people would look at Marshall, who carried the name, he's Marshall Jr., that's Marshall C. They would look at him and say, oh, he's the spitting image of his father. Now, I don't see that. They saw that in that day. And I sure don't know where the spitting comes from, you know. But that's pretty close, because people in those days would say, boy, when I see that baby, even though he's this big and a little chubby, he reminds me of his father, who's 6 feet tall, and because they both have curly hair, right? Runs in the family, you can tell. That is close to, I think, what God has in mind when he says, I'm going to give you my image. So that if people want to know what I'm like, you're the ones I've commissioned to show them, to tell them. Boy, that's a pretty scary charge, isn't it? But there it is, five times in a row in the book of Genesis. So how can we do that? How can we do that? We have to do that in such a way that it kind of stops people in their tracks, gets their attention, and makes them think maybe the world should be different. Maybe I should be different. A lot of people in the United States, a lot of Christians, are fearful and concerned because we're becoming a more secular society. There was Europe first, kind of secularized, swept over to Canada. It's leaking down. And a lot of Christians are quite concerned about that. I grew up in the South, part of the United States, back in the 1950s. And it was just kind of assumed. Everybody went to church. You go to the grocery store and buy some things. They say, what church y'all go to, honey? <laughs> You know? Well, I don't go to church. What? You don't go to church? Everybody goes to church in where I grew up. And people are concerned because now not everybody does. Well, that doesn't bother me at all. In fact, I think the gospel actually works best among people in a society where people are very unlike Jesus, so that we can show them what Jesus is like, and it stands out in contrast. If everybody is nice and polite and goes to church, you know, it's kind of hard to tell which ones are the real ones and which ones are just kind of learned behavior. Well, that was true in the early church. People are concerned about trends in North America now, man, you should have been back in Rome. Any problem we've got, they had much worse. So, for example, issues that are big in the church, abortion. They didn't do abortion in the Roman Empire. This is what they did. They let the babies be born 9 months in the womb, out of the womb, a living baby, and they would just abandon it by the side of the road. That was their form of birth control. Historians tell us about a third of all babies born in the Roman Empire were just abandoned like that. And the Christians came along and said, well, that's not right. That baby is born in God's image. That baby has something of God's image in it. We can't just abandon it to wild animals, to weather. So they had organized platoons of wet nurses to keep them alive until they found a Christian family to adopt them. And in those days, I mean, we know what it's like when a disease like polio or Ebola or AIDS or coronavirus spreads. People are terrified and they get a little out of control. And that was true in the Roman Empire. They had bubonic plague. Bubonic plague. And so what happens when bubonic plague hits your town? The Romans would flee into the mountains to get away so they didn't get sick. But not the Christians. The Christians would stay behind and nurse not only their relatives, but their pagan neighbors' relatives. And after a while, the Romans started thinking, I like the way they live better than the way I live. What do they have? I want to be like one of them. And there really weren't any evangelists, there weren't any missionaries, there weren't any seeker churches in those days. They were just Christians kind of huddled together, but living differently. Some of them became martyrs, and that was another deal. Roman culture was a very entertainment-oriented culture, too. And when I come to Canada, one of the things that I can never quite figure out, I find people are much more civilized, they're kind of introverted, and they're proper and polite and gentle. I'm sure you have exceptions, but that's kind of, you know, compared to Texans, for example. and so what do most of them do on Sunday? Well, they have this sport where they bash each other in the face with sticks. This is what they do. They go and watch people fight. These nice, gentle Canadians. Well, what did the Romans do? The Romans took people they didn't like and put them in a big stadium and turned lions and tigers and elephants loose on them. And gladiators. Why? Oh, it's so fun to see them plead and cry and say, help me, have mercy. And occasionally the emperor would say, okay, let him live. I mean, what a way to spend Sunday afternoon, right? And the Christians ruined it because they would get together and say, they want us to act terrified. We're not going to do that. And they would stand in the middle of the arena, hold hands, sing songs, and pray. What fun is that? And gradually it changed the whole culture. That's how the gospel tends to spread, because people start thinking, they're different than I am. Why are they different? There's something, there's a different image going on inside them. I had an example of that in my own state not that long ago. I had written a book on prayer, and I was speaking at my church in Colorado on prayer. And as I studied the book on prayer, I kept running into this phrase that Jesus would say, love your enemies, pray for those who persecute you. And the United States had several wars going on at the time, as usual, you know, Iraq, Afghanistan, I thought. And before then, I'd been to Russia, and then, of course, Nazi Germany. And I thought, I have never once prayed for my enemies. That's an interesting concept. Why would Jesus come up with that? So at that meeting, I brought a picture of some of our enemies. In those days, it was members of Al-Qaeda. And these are actual people. And they are enemies. They're trying to kill Americans, Canadians. You've served in those places too. And NATO forces. And I said, what would happen if every church in North America adopted one of those guys, learned to pronounce his name, and prayed for him? Didn't Jesus tell us to do that? I've never even thought of that before. I didn't know it, but there was a colonel in the U.S. Army. There's a base 2 hours away, Fort Carson. He drove up to hear me speak, and that got to him. He said, I've served in Iraq. I've served in Afghanistan. I've tried to kill my enemies. I've never once thought of praying for them. And Philip's right. Jesus said, we should do that. So he went back and started a website. I'm not making this up. This is true. It's still true. Called Adopt a Terrorist for Prayer. ATFP.org. And if you go online, you'll see these pictures like I showed you, and you'll see a little profile of these enemies, how bad they are. You know, Osama bin Laden used to be one of them, and he got knocked off, and various ones. And you have to agree to pray. That's the point. Well, this guy's commanding general really didn't appreciate this idea. What the? We're trying to get our guys to kill these people, and you want them to pray for them? What a crazy idea. And you can go on his website and see responses like that from other soldiers as well. And actually, that's a great response. That's a response the disciples had when Jesus first said that. That's crazy. Why would you do that? And Jesus said very simply, because that's the only way people are going to know what my Father is like. Because that's what God does for you. Because he causes the rain to fall on the righteous and the unrighteous, and the sun to shine on the godly and the ungodly. And the only way such a crazy countercultural idea can get across is if you show them by loving your enemies, because you are God's enemies and God loves you anyhow. That's what it means to bear the image of God, to take the most unlikely character and somehow out of it produce something that reminds us of what God is like. I've learned that from leprosy patients. One that appears often in my writings with Dr. Brand, I brought a picture of him, is a man named Sadan. You can see his right hand on the left side. His right hand has been operated on. Dr. Brand devised these tendon surgeries. The left hand, not so much anymore. So they will gradually fix that. And Sadan came to the Brands in India fairly early in their the treatments that they were learning to provide. When he showed up, he had been, most of the leprosy patients in India were from the lower castes, often the what was used to be called the untouchable caste, now called Dalits. But not all. Sadan was kind of from a middle-class background. He was educated. He studied as an accountant. When he showed up, he was kicked out of his village first, his family, because they were so afraid of leprosy, and he got on this bus. And the bus got fairly close to the hospital, but then rumors started that he had leprosy, so they actually kicked him, literally kicked him with the bus driver's foot off the bus. And he showed up walking several miles with bandaged feet, leaving a little blood spot every time he took a step. And he came to this house because he heard there was one orthopedic surgeon in the world for 12 million leprosy patients. Only one, Dr. Paul Brand, was trying these different techniques to make you use your hands again, to free your feet. So he made his way there, and Dr. Brand went out and met him, and he didn't know about the contagion at the time, too. So he was a little nervous, but he put his hand on his shoulder, and Sadan burst into tears. "Well, did I say something wrong?" "No, no. It's just that for many months, no one has ever touched me." He lacked that human touch. And he became kind of one of the top patients, favorite patients of Dr. Brand. He'd let them try anything. One of the kind of advantages of not feeling pain is you don't need anesthetic for surgery. So they would actually operate on his hand with no drugs at all, and he would be carrying on a conversation during the operation. And it worked. They repaired his hands. You can see the difference in the two hands, and finally they got them both back. And Sadan was so proud, he thought, "Now I can return to my village, to my home. They'll accept me again." So he went home for a weekend, and they had a big family celebration, great meal. And then that night, he was back on his mat on the floor again for the first time in a long time, and he was going to sleep so well, slept very soundly. The next morning, he woke up, and he looked at his hand, and his hand was a mangled mess. What happened? What happened? What happened was that he slept so soundly and not feeling pain that a rat came into the room and chewed his hand. And he just burst into tears. "What? How am I going to tell the Brands they've invested so much in me? I feel so careless. I feel so ashamed." He was staying one more night, so he said, "I can't even sleep tonight. I will just stay up all night so that I don't go to sleep." They bandaged the one hand that was so mangled. To stay awake, he started reading his book on accounting. Bad idea. Because about 2 o'clock in the morning, he started nodding, and then finally he went to sleep, and his good hand fell over and touched the kerosene lantern. The next morning he woke up, and it was just a mass of fused tissue, burned, open wounds. And he went back to the hospital with each hand bandaged, just distraught, disconsolate, after months and months of rehab and repair. And Dr. Brand said, "I'll never forget." He said, when Sadan came to him, he said, I'll never be free without pain." I met Sadan. I went to his home. He's a funny, funny little guy. He was bald by then, completely bald. He looked a little bit like Gandhi. He had these big round glasses, sat cross-legged on his bed. He talked in this very high kind of sing-song voice, and he told me the whole story of his life, including what I just told you, only it took him more than 30 minutes to tell the story. And then at the very end he said, "But I am happy. I am so happy that I had the disease leprosy." And I said, "Sadan, how can you possibly say that? That's one of the worst stories I've ever heard." And he pointed to a photo of him, of Paul and Margaret Brand, and he said, underneath it said, "May the spirit of the God who lives in them live also in me." And he said, "If I had not had the disease leprosy, I would never have met them. They bore the image of God, the likeness of God to Sadan." We all have that capacity. We all have that charge, actually. And I know some of you are sitting there saying, "Well, I'm not an orthopedic surgeon. I'm just an ordinary person. Nobody would write a story about me." Well, maybe not. Maybe not. Ephesians 2, when Paul is describing what we are to God, he uses this word. It's a Greek word. He says, "You are God's poema. You are God's work of art. You are God's handiwork. You are God's thing of artistic pride, God's poem. That's what you are." And because each one of us has the potential to bear God's image, no matter what your set of qualities are. I don't care whether you're beautiful or ugly, whether you're brilliant or stupid. I don't care. Every one of us, whether you're completely healthy or disabled, has the potential to carry the image of God, to bear something of God's image. That came home to me in a very strong way when I went to a leprosy hospital in Nepal. It was a hospital called Green Pastures. And we were given a tour. It took about a half an hour. The doctor showed us around, met us, and took us first through this courtyard, which is about the size of the middle section here, back to that wall. And when I looked across the courtyard, I saw this woman, obviously a leprosy patient, who, I got to tell you, she's one of the least attractive people I've ever seen. She was ugly. And we kept going and got a tour of the hospital. And then when we came back, this woman had made her way all the way across the courtyard. She didn't have any toes. Her feet were all bandaged. I could see that. She had no fingers left. They were all worn down. They had been absorbed through, maybe she used tools that had splinters in them or something, or cooking implements. She burned her fingers. I don't know. She was blind, had been blind for years. She had calluses on her eyes. And her nose had shrunken away so that when you looked at her, you looked right into her skull. Not a pretty sight. And she couldn't walk. So she moved by planting her elbows in the ground and kind of dragging her body behind her, a little bit like a caterpillar, kind of humping along across. And while we were given that tour, this woman had made her way all the way across that courtyard on grass, dragging her body to the sidewalk because she heard us, she could hear, she figured she knew it was a foreign language and I guess she wanted to meet us. So we saw this woman, we stopped, and I figured, well, she must be a beggar because, you know, this is Nepal, people like that, she couldn't have a job. So I kind of reached into my pocket to see if I had some coins, maybe I could give this woman. My wife, who is a social worker and hospice chaplain, had a very different and more holy reaction. She went to this woman and kneeled down beside her, put her arm around her, and the woman started singing. We don't know Nepali, but we didn't really need to know Nepali. We knew the words. It was, Jesus loves me, this I know, for the Bible tells me so. The doctor said to me, Philip, I want you to meet Don Maya. Don Maya is no beggar. She's the closest thing to a saint that I know. Every time the chapel door is open, Don Maya is there greeting you. And in fact, do you have any prayer requests? Because strangely enough, Don Maya's prayers tend to get answered. Wow. And I went away first convicted at my initial reaction and then just marveling that the God of the universe, the God who spun off galaxies, the God who gave us the Rocky Mountains and the Pacific Ocean and this planet could make a home in somebody like Don Maya, who by any standard of the world's success was a failure. She has no money, she has no beauty, she has no job, she has no resume. But God looked at Don Maya and said, she's made in my image, and I can glow inside that woman, that sadly deformed woman. And that's the promise that we all have, and that's the charge that we are given as individuals to bear the image of God in such a way that people will look at us and say, oh, huh, I never knew God was like that. I never knew God was like that. We do it in such inconsistent and flawed ways. Ephesians and Colossians both say that Jesus was the exact image of the invisible God. That's such a comfort to me in my faith. The book you referred to, Ken, just when I got to know Jesus, I got to know God. And that was so different from the God I grew up with. You know, the scowling policeman in the sky And then I would compare it to Jesus, and I'd get to that verse. Jesus is the exact image of the invisible God. And if your image of God doesn't look like Jesus, clean up the image. Clean up the image. Because God gave us Jesus so that we would know, oh, that's what the Father's like. That's what I'm like. Well, we're not, most of us in the church. We're flawed, refracted, stained, cracked, incomplete images of God. But I, because I'm a journalist, I get to go around the world and I see how we do, Christians do and have over the centuries. Everywhere I go where there are missionaries have been, I see clinics and orphanages and hospitals and schools. Because these missionaries go and they just can't help creating goodness around them. And it's still there. I was in Korea a few years ago, and I heard about this guy, and I wanted to look him up. And he was a pastor of a church about this size, nothing special, just kind of an ordinary church in Seoul, Korea. And much like the people in Rome, in South Korea, abortion is illegal. So if you have a baby you don't want, you let the baby be born, and then you throw it away. And so every day, hundreds of babies in Seoul are found in Dempsey dumpsters, unwanted. It's a shame culture, and if you're unmarried and you have a baby, you want to get rid of it. And this pastor started thinking, that's not right. That's wrong. God's not happy with that. So he did something. He, in the side of his church, he drilled a hole, and he installed what he calls a baby box. And it's a little bit like a late night depository in a bank. And he advertises, if you don't want your baby, bring it here. And when you open the box, an alarm sounds. So he gets up in the middle of the night. It's always at 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning. And he says, and he comes down and he says, don't be afraid, don't be afraid. I'm not going to tell anybody, but we'll take care of your baby. We'll make sure your baby is cared for. And would you like to stay in touch? Because if you'd like, I can tell you where the baby goes. I can let you know what happens to your baby. Many of them say no, they don't want anything to do with it. He says, that's fine. But there's a blanket, there's a light, and they take that baby in. And he started taking one after another, and people would come and help him. And shortly after I visited him, he celebrated his 1,000th baby rescued. He found places for almost all of them. There were 23 babies that were so severely deformed that he couldn't get anybody to accept the responsibility of caring for them, just the health issues. You know what he did? He adopted all 23. They're his children. I have another picture of my wife playing some kind of game with all these kind of deformed and disabled babies. It was like a preview of the kingdom of God. God's image dwells in them. I've written about the church I grew up in. It wasn't a healthy church. It was a toxic church. I've been trying to recover from it ever since. And I often ask myself, why did God trust us with God's image? If I was God, I wouldn't have done it that way. If I were God, I would want to do it myself. This is what I am like. Well, he kind of tried that in the Old Testament. Nobody could stand it, you know? Actually, if you read the Bible, it's pretty clear that God planned this all along. First, in the Old Testament primarily, he did reveal himself as a shining, powerful potentate, this unbelievably sovereign, majestic, pure, holy, perfect God. Yeah. That's right. In the New Testament, he became one of us. Jesus came to show us what that looks like in human terms. To give us an exact image of what God is like as a human being. And Jesus did some incredible things. But you know what? He didn't do anything for North America or China or India or South America or Australia. He only affected a few thousand people in a tiny little corner of the Roman Empire, and he only worked for 3 years. And then he said, okay, it's finished. My work is done. Because now it's up to you. You're my church. So I want you to go to Judea, Samaria, places I never got to, and show them what God is like. And I look at the way we've done that, you know, the spotted, I know all the problems with the church throughout history and certainly the one I grew up in. And I keep thinking, surely there was a better way. But according to the New Testament, there wasn't. That was the best way because God's purpose was to grow that image, to show that image through us. The best analogy I can come up with is something comes out of my hometown. Evergreen, Colorado. It's a little town of 7,000 people up in the hills. And they have a high school, and the high school still has an orchestra. It's a group looks kind of like this. These kids in blue jeans and t-shirts. And I love classical music. When we lived in Chicago, we had front row seats to the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, one of the best in the world, for 15 years. Then I went to Colorado and heard the Evergreen High School Orchestra. Every once in a while, in fact, pretty often, the Evergreen High School Orchestra will tackle a piece of music that they have no business doing. And what I've learned is that when the Evergreen High School Orchestra plays Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, don't blame Beethoven. The stuff that comes out of that group, that's not what the maestro had in mind. It's out of tune. It's screechy, scratchy. It's the wrong rhythm. And if Beethoven could only hear it, he would be appalled. And yet, the only way a lot of people in the foothills west of Denver, Colorado, have ever even heard of Beethoven, much less heard his music, is because of the Evergreen High School Orchestra. And every once in a while, they hit it right. A note of harmony, a note of grace. And I think that's the way it is with the church. God has given us the music, the score, and said, it's up to you guys now. Play the tune of grace. Play the tune of forgiveness, mercy, of justice, of love. The world needs it. It needs that tune. And I'm trusting you with that message. Now go. Go and get it across. Jesus was the express image of the invisible God. We're not. We're badly refracted. But we are the only way that the world will know. It's up to us to make God visible. God is invisible. The only way the world will know what God is like is if we show them. That's what the body of Christ is all about. Jesus isn't here in a bodily form anymore. He's gone. He left. But he said, my body's still here. My body's you. Some of you are one kind of cell. Some of you are a different kind of cell. But you all have a part in my body. And together, we can demonstrate God's image. I'm going to introduce Kim Evans, who's head of Effect Hope. She's already met her. And they are a branch of God's body. I sit in my little office in Colorado and write while people are out with the hands and feet in places where they're digging wells and healing diseases and taking care of orphans and doing all these wonderful things. And I'm so glad we each have a part in all of that. We are the bearers of God's image. It's a marvelous thing. We don't do it well. But that's what we're called to do. And I think the fact that you are here today is a sign that you accept that charge and want to do it in a way, because the world definitely urgently needs examples of what God had in mind with the human race. So let's show them. Amen.